In the United States, we've had chains of hospitals shut down and moving to manual operations for weeks on end.
Welcome to Shield of the Republic, a podcast sponsored by the Bulwark and the Miller Center of Public Affairs at the University of Virginia. I'm Eric Edelman, counselor at the Center for Strategic and Budgetary Assessments, non-resident fellow at the Miller Center and a Bulwark contributor. And I'm joined by my colleague in all things strategery, returning from Israel, Elliot Cohen, professor emeritus of strategy at the Johns Hopkins School of Advanced International Studies, contributing writer to The Atlantic. Welcome back to the United States.
Well, it's good to be back. I'm a little bit jet lagged, but hit the ground running. We're going to be a little bit pressed for time today, so maybe probably what we should do is we should take care of our introductory material on the jackasseries of the week before I introduce our esteemed guest, if that's okay with you.
That's fine.
Let me lead off. I know you have a long litany of things and they're actually serious, but I'm going to do something which you told me will annoy many of our listeners and throw a bouquet for a change at none other than Ted Cruz, who's not normally somebody that I think is the best, but I thought he made quite a principled argument about the Trump administration going after free speech. And the reason why I think it's significant is not because I necessarily think he's a moral paragon, but my view's always been that the most dangerous part of this presidency would be the first 9 to 18 months. And gradually you're going to begin seeing people say there's a life after Trump, and nobody's really going to replace him with the hold that he had. And that maybe, you know, if you do things which really violate people's, some core principles of the Constitution, it can come back and bite you. So I feel very good, particularly given that Rosh Hashanah is about to begin. And, you know, it's the period where you're kind of searching your soul, that I can say something nice for a change.
About Ted Cruz, no less. And, you know, you could have thrown in Rand Paul,
Rand
as well.
Paul, yep.
Well, I just, you know, I wanted to draw attention to our president's deep and keen grasp of history. He noted that he wanted Bagram Airfield back from the Taliban, and if not, bad things were going to happen because we built it, damn it. Well, you know, actually the Soviets built it. I mean, it's true that over the 20 years that we were there, we put a fair amount of investment into infrastructure, but maybe the president should have thought of that during his first term when he negotiated the terrible deal with the Taliban that he made Mike Pompeo sign at Doha. I'm also, you know, going to go back to something we've been talking about on previous shows. We now have the third strike on a boat off of Venezuela. The administration still, after three strikes, has yet to show a shred of evidence upon which they've based these strikes, nor a legal rationale for them. More and more stories coming out about the discomfort of military lawyers and folks in the chain of command about this. And when you put that together with the new press rules that the Pentagon is trying to impose on the Pentagon press corps, and look, no one gets it better than me. I knew how infuriating it used to be when the Pentagon press corps was revealing things about conversations that had taken place in the sit room or, classified information, but it just goes with the territory. And to try and force the Pentagon press corps to essentially submit to, prior restraint, pre-approval of what they write is, I think, incredibly dangerous for a democracy. So there you have it.
Yeah. Well, you know, I remember talking to one Pentagon correspondent when a previous administration, actually, either the Obama or the Biden administration, was trying to similarly, you know, crack down on reporters getting anonymous sources. And he said, you know, they don't have a chance against us. You know, people are always going to be reaching out to us and we'll get the news. All very depressing stuff. What's much more cheering is our guest this week. And it's a real pleasure to welcome to the show Ann Neuberger. Ann had got her master's degrees in both business and international affairs from Columbia University, where she worked with a colleague and friend of mine, Dick Betts. She was in the financial sector for a bit. And then in 2007, she became a White House fellow, which I think is when we first had a set of long conversations, which I remember. She went on to a number of positions in the Navy. In 2019, General Paul Nakasone asked her to become the first director of cybersecurity at the National Security Agency. And in 2021, she became the Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology in the Biden White House. She's now out of office and having a grand life lecturing at Stanford and being a fellow at the Hoover Institution, lots of other things as well. She's written a wonderful essay, which people should read in Foreign Affairs, called China is Winning the Cyber War. America needs a new strategy of deterrence. So, Anne, welcome to Shield of the Republic.
It's great to be here with both of you. And indeed, I think I met you both for the first time in 2007. So this is a good conversation for many reasons.
This is great. Tell you what, could you maybe just begin by talking about an episode which is really in some ways at the center of your article? You mentioned something called Salt Typhoon. And I think those of us who don't, I think a lot of people who don't necessarily follow cyber issues very closely keep on, you know, seeing these sort of strange phrases, bronze rain, or, you know, any of a number of things. And we have a sense that it's something bad, but we don't know exactly what it is. What was Salt Typhoon? Why should we care about it?
Salt Typhoon was the Chinese compromise of a number of American telecoms, large American telecoms. By the way, it represents a part of their campaign around the world, compromising telecoms, with the goal of, frankly, collecting the lodestar information that's on them from people's private communications, whether that's a senior political leader or a corporate executive, corporate secrets, national secrets, as well as, you know, using access to the telecom network to geolocate, to find individuals who might be visiting sensitive sites, et cetera. So China essentially used access to our telecom system they built over time through a series of techniques to turn the U.S. telecom system into an intelligence collection system for them. So broad-scale espionage, deeply concerning for the access China got, and deeply concerning because it took some telecoms potentially as long as 3 years to actually find it. So it's a window into our own system, China's intelligence success, and frankly, America's intelligence failure in both not detecting it and not blocking it earlier.
And you also talk in the article as well about malicious software and things like that, which really pose a lot of potential threats to American infrastructure, not just military infrastructure, but civilian infrastructure as well. Could you say a few words about that? And then over to you, Eric.
You know, we've long known that China had a broad and capable espionage program around the world. What changed in the last few years was the development of an active, focused Chinese cyber warfare program, seeking to gain access to military and critical infrastructure systems in the US, in allied countries, in Asia Pacific, and in Europe. We believe with the intention of potentially disabling or disrupting those systems during periods of crisis or conflict. So this is actually an interesting time to be having the conversation because, as you know, several airports across Europe have been disabled by cyber attacks this week, leading to canceled flights. And that could be a good example of what China might have in mind, for example, gaining access to airport systems with the goal of disabling those just, for example, long enough to delay military deployments from the U.S. in a period of crisis or in a period of conflict. So while there's certainly absolutely no evidence that what occurred in Europe is tied to China, in fact, it looks more likely that it's a criminal ransomware group. It gives a picture of the degree of connectivity of systems like those today and the impact in the hands of a nation state adversary that knows that both our military and private sector systems all ride on the same digital infrastructure.
You know, and your article does, I think, a terrific job of making the point, going back to Elliot's, you know, opening question about Salt Typhoon and why should we care, that this was not just a hack. And I think a lot of people, I mean, a lot of our listeners and viewers may have heard of Salt Typhoon. They may know that it was some kind of Chinese cyber operation. But the point you make, it's not just a hack. It's actually part of a broader bid for what you call cyber dominance. And it is a reflection of the fact, I think, that, you know, as you were just suggesting, we frequently talk about the U.S. and China being involved in a competition, strategic competition, a cyber competition. But in the cyber domain, we're really kind of in conflict with them every day because they're offensive and defensive operations both sides are engaged in literally constantly. And again, you make a point that struck home to me because I co-chaired, as you know, a commission for the Congress on the National Defense Strategy that reported last year. And we similarly cited what you cited, which was the public testimony of former FBI Director Wray, that the PRC has got cyber penetrations and is sitting at crucial elements of our national infrastructure throughout the country, whether it's the electric grid, water purification systems, transit systems, in particular, things that could impede, as you point out in your article, the mobilization of U.S. military forces in a time of crisis, but also could inflict enormous civilian damage, not only on the economy, but just on people's everyday way of life. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Absolutely. You know, one of the things that the reason Salt Typhoon and frankly China's campaign is so important to study is because it actually represents a clash of two very different systems in cyberspace. China's an authoritarian country, and its critical infrastructure is made up of many state-owned enterprises. What that means is that China has a system of firewalls that it uses to monitor both domestic communications and domestic networks. So they can detect and most likely block cyber attacks in a capable way. And given that their critical power pipelines, telecoms are largely state-owned, they can also define both minimum cybersecurity requirements, but also monitor those networks as well. The United States is a democracy, and much of our critical infrastructure, you know, we're talking over 95%, is owned and operated by private sector companies. That means that the U.S. government does not monitor even critical airport networks, water networks, power networks, and as such is not positioned to detect and certainly not block cyber attacks. And that means that that sets us up for a different model of deterrence and, frankly, a different considerations in using offensive or cyber warfare capabilities, because in cyberspace, defense and offense are inextricably linked. As you have both taught and written so extensively, right? In any competition or crisis or conflict between countries, countries are seeking the advantage. And in this case, when taking a first shot, one always considers what will the response be and can one defend against that? The U.S. is in far less of a position to defend against a retaliatory response. And as such, our deterrence is significantly hamstrung by that asymmetry in the model between China as an authoritarian country and America, and frankly, the West, this is not only the U.S., as a democracy.
Can I follow up a little bit on the question of retaliation? I thought one of the things, there are a lot of very interesting things in the article. One of them is that you don't just talk about defense, although cyber defense is critical. You know, cyber defense has been an issue which I've been hearing about for years and years and years. But you talk about the importance of being able to retaliate. Now, the question I suppose that I have is, if you have an enemy who is willing to, say, shut down commercial air travel, or is willing to really mess around with things that ensure clean drinking water to a major city. And let's say they do that for whatever reason, to send a message. What is the right kind of retaliation? I mean, I presume, you know, there are extremes we should not go to, or we would not go to. Does the retaliation always have to be a cyber retaliation? That is to say, is it always an electron for an electron, or should it sometimes be, you know, something much more material in response to an electron? Could you just walk us through how you think about that?
You know, the question you ask is at the root of the policy discussions and debates that have been occurring across Republican and Democratic administrations. As cyberspace evolved, and frankly, as our economy and national security was built out on the same interconnected digital infrastructure, Right. So the water systems that our military bases rely on are the same water systems that the Americans living, you know, near military bases around the country rely on. Similarly, we have one national power grid. Our service members deploy from the same ports and airports that you and I fly out of. And that means that that makes cyberspace a very different arena than the traditional homeland and battleground, particularly for the United States, where we have an ocean on either side. And as such, when we think about what security in cyberspace means, for us, what we want to ensure first is that the critical systems that Americans rely on every day, the trains to get to work, the clean water coming out of the tap, are secure and frankly are resilient. And that's why I raise the difference in models, because that's far harder in the US. And in the article, I talk about the fact to say, we shouldn't just throw up our hands. Absolutely not. We need to, as a country, think creatively. And I think AI is transformative in this way of how we secure those critical systems that Americans rely on each and every day, because that is the foundational responsibility the government owes its citizens. We've made a lot of progress in that, notably President Biden's decision to put in place minimum cybersecurity requirements using emergency authorities that had never been done before across both Republican and Democratic administrations. That was a key first step in saying government has a role in ensuring these systems are secure. But we need to build on that for exactly the reasons you say, because a key part of deterrence is saying we will attribute an attack. That's harder in cyberspace. Happy to talk about it, but that also is something distinct. We will attribute. We are resilient, meaning even if an attack is successful, we can recover quickly enough to prevent significant impact, and we will credibly retaliate. And for the US, I believe credible retaliation really rides on adequately resilient infrastructure to where we're not so concerned about an escalatory tit for tat that we don't withhold that first retaliatory shot.
And if I could, I just would like to expand on, I'm sorry, Elliot, just one thing that I think would be illuminating for our listeners so they understand a little bit better something you said earlier, which is this asymmetry between China with its Great Wall and with the U.S. The progress you just described is basically trying to overcome gaps that exist because in the U.S. system, NSA, where you used to work, and Cybercom have the responsibility for defending .mil. .gov, the responsibility rests really with DHS, which for years has had some difficulty in meeting that responsibility. And nobody was responsible for .com, on which many things we in the government, particularly in the military side, since I spent a lot of time in the Pentagon, a lot of our stuff resides on, as you were kind of suggesting earlier, .com. And so these emergency authorities you're talking about in the Biden administration really were making folks in .com who were responsible for their own protection, but were protecting things that were of importance to the nation, take minimum steps to meet that bar.
That's exactly right. So for really the last attempt on the Hill to take meaningful cyber legislation was in 2015, the Lieberman-Collins bill that took, you know, that attempt, it failed, but it was an attempt to really look at critical infrastructure and recognize that setting aside military national security systems, that critical infrastructure are the key systems, and our voluntary approach, certainly, you know, some companies made the investments needed, but we see again and again that these are companies that, you know, are responsible for managing revenues and costs, cybersecurity is an expense, and they often weren't taking adequate steps. Further, in many cases, they're up against governments, capable governments. And I think one of the powerful approaches of putting in place minimum cybersecurity requirements, as the Biden administration did, and that we needed to do that sector by sector. So President Biden had the National Security Council do an extensive review after the Colonial Pipeline hack, and said, find how we can fix this. And we did an extensive review, doing a lawyers group at the White House, and found that there were old safety regulations that had existed in an analog world, and that we could reinterpret those to say, much as a signaling system, when mechanical, had to be secure, a signaling system now that's on the internet must be secure. And working with those regulators, to your point of who was responsible, who also knew their sectors. Because the second approach in the past that had been taken, which I think wasn't exactly right, was to say will take one approach to critical infrastructure. But in reality, how one secures hospitals is different from how one secures a water system. And the regulatory agencies that both had those relationships and understood those systems best could ensure that the minimum requirements were done in as least burdensome a way as possible and as maximally effective a way as possible. Now, overseeing that approach and ensuring that agencies learn from each other, that certainly should be the Department of Homeland Security and CISA. But the regulatory piece of ensuring companies take the steps needed and that a regulatory agency is inspecting it and doing it along the way was a critical step President Biden did that started to have a transformative impact. You know, literally, I had a spreadsheet on my desk, for example, given to me by TSA, the regulator for airports, that had every one of the airports in the country rated red, yellow, and green against minimum cybersecurity requirements, like monitoring their system or having multi-factor authentication. And we'd meet regularly to track the moves from red to yellow and yellow to green. And I will tell you that the majority were red at the beginning of the administration. Most had moved to yellow for pipelines. All pretty much had moved to green because that was the first sector that we had started with following Colonial Pipeline. But that kind of follow through and visibility hadn't been done before. And it's the first step, right? Because the second step is actually building an approach that tests these systems against adversaries' capabilities, that uses intelligence about China's offensive cyber capabilities, Russia's cyber warfare program, to actually test them against a virtual replica, which AI now allows us to do.
Yeah, that's one of the particularly interesting parts of the article where you talk about basically creating digital twins of actual systems that you can test robustly. I would like to go back, though, to retaliation, because I completely understand the defense part. I completely understand the resilience part. Who could possibly object? But the retaliation part is essential, too, because if the other side doesn't pay a penalty for continuing to try to do these things, they'll keep on doing it. And I don't think, you know, in a kinetic battle, if you attack somebody and you're not successful, you're paying a price in terms of casualties and so forth. In the cyber world, I don't particularly get a sense. You try an attack, the attack doesn't work. You know, I don't know, you've paid whatever the amount of time that you've been online is, but it's pretty trivial. So the retaliation part strikes me as being essential. And really my question to you is, does that retaliation need to be in cyber? Does that retaliation, can it be tit for tat? That doesn't feel right to me. If it's not, how should we think about it? Because these are different societies. And we would, you know, if somebody attacks our hospital system, you know, are we going to feel really okay with shutting down some essential functions at all the hospitals in Beijing?
Our lawyers won't let us do that.
Yeah,
exactly.
It violates the law of armed conflict.
Want to do that. So tell us how do you think about that part?
Yeah, and I want to break your question, Elliot, into two parts. One is, if an adversary conducts an attack, you know, that has a physical impact on a system, we've said that will be treated as an act of war and will be responded with accordingly. I think the deeper question we've had is now, when, for example, as former director of FBI Chris Wray said, we find China with pre-positioned access and capability to disrupt a system in the future, what is the appropriate response to make clear that's unacceptable? Particularly when those systems are systems that have no espionage value, like a water system, right? And that has been the biggest challenge in our policy approach because, you know, our declaratory, our position is that if you conduct an attack with physical impact, we will respond accordingly. We'll treat it as an act of war. However, the speed of conducting an attack, once an adversary has access to a system, they can conduct it at will and so quickly that we can't deter or likely prevent it. So as such, we actually don't want China positioned anywhere in our critical infrastructure. Now, when we find them, the first step has been, you know, one of the key steps we've taken is attributing it, actually saying publicly, we have found you, to make clear that we both know what they've done and have demonstrated the capability to actually attribute, because that's a key part of cyberspace. That capability has evolved. And one of the things that made cyberspace useful is that it was sometimes hard to pin who did what. And as a result, that gave some more freedom of maneuver, For example, for a use case where an adversary would want to disable an airport for a period of time just to delay a military mobilization, but not necessarily want it pinned on them. They want to make it look like an accident or a technology failure. Those happen often enough. So the showing that we can attribute was one key way to do so. But actually saying, what should be the response when we find an entity pre-positioned? Should we, for example, deploy a capability on their military equivalent system? Do they have, for example, in China, water systems that largely support a base to get at the point that we talked about a moment, that Eric mentioned a moment earlier, that using civilian systems both counters the law of armed conflict and is not something that we would do. But that, what is an appropriate response to make clear that the lines we are setting are meaningful and credible, is the area of policy that we have grappled with. And one of the things I propose in the article is to say two things. Part one, let's use digital replicas to actually test our most critical systems and get them more resilient. And then part two, that then frees up our hands to, when we find an adversary in our infrastructure, conduct some form of, whether it's pre-positioning in their systems and then tell them we can do this too, and neither of us wants to be in this position, and feel that we are then able to credibly conduct those kinds of activities. But you're getting to the core point that has been a challenge for us to consider: what is appropriate and how do we do so in a way that signals our credible red lines, but also does so without being escalatory.
I have to tell you, I'm still wrestling with the question of retaliation. And, part of what I think I end up thinking is, we will not always, we should retaliate. I completely agree with you. Doing those things are acts of war. If they're acts of war, we don't necessarily have to retaliate in the same domain. We can retaliate in other ways. Different kind of question. As long as I've paid any attention to this, you have people talking about cyber Pearl Harbors and painting pretty cataclysmic pictures of what will happen. And then in the real world, bad stuff happens, like, Heathrow being shut down and, massive disruptions to flight systems as occurred this past week. But if you look at some of the cases which really are kind of real warlike, say the Russian cyber attack on Estonia, or even more, I'd say the Russian cyber attacks on Ukraine in advance of the invasion, bad and clearly did damage. But actually, in the Ukrainian case, to the extent I understand it, what's striking to me is the resilience, not only of the Ukrainians, but also, of course, the Ukrainians with the help of a lot of other entities, including private entities that got engaged, which by the way, it seems to me is that that's another part of this, that it's not just the government alone, it's the government working with private sector companies. So why haven't we yet seen, a really devastating cyber attack? I suppose that's my question. We've seen things, but I don't think we've seen anything really like science fiction scary.
I actually think we have seen devastating cyber attacks. We've hesitated to really. So in the United States, we've had chains of hospitals shut down and moving to manual operations for weeks on end. The CEO of Ascension Healthcare briefed at a meeting that the ransomware attack on their network of hospitals was so bad that they had to hire runners to run images from MRI into surgery. None of us would want to be in that hospital during that period. And that went on for 2 months, right? So I actually think we've had those kinds of devastating attacks. And however, they haven't been and broad enough across critical infrastructure at the same time to where there weren't other systems people could lean on, right? So Ascension's, they have hospitals across 8 or 10 states. There are enough other hospitals people could go to that when they canceled all emergency and all elective services, there were alternatives. Similarly, Russia conducted an attack on the satellite company providing all communications to Ukraine's military, as you noted, the night before the invasion. If not for the fact that Elon Musk and Starlink stepped up, Ukraine's military would have had no means of secure communications. And we don't know what the impact would have been on the success. It felt like the Russian invasion was so poorly executed in any event. But they would have, they seriously, the Russians were successful at completely disabling Ukraine's ability for secure military communications, if not for an alternative. So I think we have had significant cyber attacks, right? The Colonial Pipeline, it was a criminal ransomware attack. It shut down the pipeline serving the entire East Coast for almost a week. I think people have almost developed the expectation that their digital infrastructure can be disrupted and that they'll just go on with life. I wonder, in the context of a crisis or a conflict, right? If what Russia did with Ukraine would happen, for example, if conflict heated up between China and Taiwan, and at that moment in time, you know, four airports near military bases suddenly had technical challenges that seemed difficult to understand, that delayed a military mobilization. I think the question we should be asking is that something we can live with? Or do we need to be in a place where if the president asks, can I feel confident that the digital infrastructure, that the most critical digital infrastructure serving our major cities, our major airports, is resilient? We should be able to say yes. And our citizens should be able to expect that it is. And I think that's not where we are yet. So I would frame the question a bit differently, because I think we're seeing it. We've just kind of come to live with it and move on. And I'm not sure we would do the same if it was a physical attack on a chain of hospitals, for example.
I mean, of course, you know, also I think all of us have experiences of things with their cyber attacks or just, you know, your iPhone stops working, that we kind of normalize it. I guess I have just one other question on this along this line. You know, you mentioned the Elon Musk story and whatever else one thinks about him. The truth is, as you say, they really came through and Starlink really came through there. Could you talk a bit about the partnership between the private sector and government, particularly in moments of crisis? I mean, you know, the Biden administration did have a notoriously scratchy relationship with the tech sector. And yet it would seem to me that if we're going to be healthy going forward, we have to have a private sector that really is kind of keen to participate in national security. Just, I don't know how you want to frame that, but if you could go after that subject.
Yes. You know, so it's so interesting to me. One of the roles, you know, as you mentioned, I spent almost 15 years at the National Security Agency. And one of the roles I played was as chief risk officer. I was asked to serve as NSA's first chief risk officer following Snowden. And what was so fascinating to me was seeing the gap between the conversation inside the agency, where people believed the intelligence operations they were doing and knew that they were lawful and that they were serving the country, and the conversation outside the agency, notably with the tech sector, that viewed these operations as completely outside the boundaries of what they thought was reasonable surveillance. And I often thought then that the responsibility really was on the intelligence community. Because for intelligence agencies in a democracy, if they're not adequately transparent, and adequate is the key word there, because these are operations that have to be done in the shadows, to where the average American, and certainly the tech companies, understand them enough to know that they're in line with American laws and values, then we've lost our core goal, which is serving and keeping America safe and people trusting and maintaining their trust in those operations. And that's something that, frankly, is playing out now as well. So in the years since the 2013 Snowden period, I've seen a recovery of that partnership. And frankly, now we're seeing a new generation of defense tech companies rolling up their sleeves and saying, we're committed to the national security of the West. We recognize there are key adversaries there, and we need to be a part of solution space. And I think what happened in Ukraine is that after, as you noted, Russia's first invasion of Ukraine of Crimea and the associated cyber attacks, Ukraine got more serious about its cybersecurity. So for example, in the months before Russia's invasion, Ukraine accelerated its move off the Soviet grid to an electricity grid connected to the European Union. That was an important move because once they were on one grid, that gave Russia an ability to really disrupt power at will. Similarly, you know, Ukraine took advantage of really the partnership of private sector companies, notably cloud companies, of moving their data into the cloud where Russia couldn't disrupt that. You know, in the initial days of Russia's invasion, there was, I recall, you know, executives at Microsoft called me that there was a wiper, a destructive malware that was just deleting data across Ukraine's government networks. And they called to make clear that they had found it and they were working to deploy defensive postures across Microsoft systems around the world. The key point there was to say, when Ukraine moved from keeping its data on its government networks and moving it to the cloud, even a destructive wiper was less impactful. So exactly to your point, Elliot, there are steps that governments, companies can take, notably together and using a new certain technologies that make them far more resistant to attack. And that absolutely needs to be done. And that partnership to say, what are the innovations that make a big difference and can be deployed cost effectively and at scale is key to a country's and a private sector's resilience and defensiveness against cyber attacks, whether they're countries or frankly criminals like ransomware attacks, which have had very debilitating impact across key sectors around the world.
And I wonder if I could, you know, push you a little bit on this question of deterrence, because earlier you were talking about the Colonial Pipeline hack. And in, I think it was May or June of 21, President Biden met with President Putin because it was, that attack did originate in Russia, apparently, and gave him a list, and you'll remember better than I, whether it was 16 or 19 pieces of elements of U.S. infrastructure that we wanted the Russians to keep their hands off. And this was meant to be a kind of deterrent and to manage the relationship. How well, in your judgment, did that work as a deterrent? I mean, my criticism at the time, and maybe it was ill-advised, was telling someone don't touch 16 or 19 or whatever the number of things is also telling them anything else I haven't got on this list is fair game. And that in that sense was not necessarily the most effective deterrent. Certainly not as effective as I think your mantra of we will attribute, we're resilient, we will retaliate. So help me unpack that a little bit.
Yeah. So President Biden met President Putin at the time. This is, of course, 6 months prior to Russia's invasion of Ukraine, and provided the list of critical infrastructure sectors. And then the two presidents set up what they called experts group. I led the U.S. side. There was a Russian FSB general from the Kremlin who led the Russian side to do the next set of work to actually define the more detailed definition. Because the challenge, as you said, rightly so, of handing over a list of sectors is both, it was both too broad and too narrow. What does too broad mean? You know, I recall a few weeks after the summit in Geneva, I got a call in the middle of the night from the Situation Room, and they said to me, Anne, there's been an attack, a ransomware attack on the Martha's Vineyard ferry. And I said, guys, that's not critical infrastructure. That's not what we meant, right? And their point was, and they were right, technically, when we say transportation sector, we actually didn't define, do we mean, you know, the Amtrak Railroad between New York and Boston? Or do we mean some random ferry in Martha's Vineyard? If we cannot detect and block an attack on a given piece of infrastructure, then it's not a credible deterrent.
I can think of at least one former president who might think that an attack on the Martha's Vineyard ferry was actually pretty serious, but never mind.
Well taken. But if so, and if we're not prepared to respond because it's not significant, then it isn't either, right? But on the other hand, and I recall the debate at the time, which was folks said, yeah, but if you make it more narrow, then you're clearly saying anything not on the list is okay. And I think that's the central tension in cyberspace, in that there is so much digital infrastructure. We need to be serious about we're setting lines that to say a disabling attack or a prepositioned attack is significant, and we will be resilient and we will retaliate. And it just is not significant enough for us to make part of a credible nation on nation. That was the work we had begun to do between the two countries. Obviously, when Russia invaded Ukraine, we broke off those discussions. But I think that's the level of detail needed to make it a credible deterrent policy. I very much agree with you.
So I would like to take this in a completely different direction, but actually keying off what you just said. Time is growing short. because the sun is setting and the Jewish New Year, which all three of us, I guess, will be observing, is upon us. I have to say, I was just thinking, I wonder what that FSB general was thinking, given that his counterpart was an Orthodox Jewish woman, which, you know, probably that's the first time in his life that he was in that position. You know, your story is a wonderful story. It's a very American story. I remember an early conversation you and I had almost 20 years ago when you were a White House fellow. What is it to be an observant Jew in the United States government? And we bonded over that. You're from a very distinguished rabbinic family. Your grandparents were Holocaust survivors. Your parents had their own incredible story. They were on that flight that was hijacked to Entebbe. You were an extremely observant Orthodox woman. Talk to us about that story and what your experiences were like and what you make of it.
You know, it's an interesting question. I'll tell you what was actually going through my mind the first time I had that conversation with General Khramov, the FSB general. Both of my grandfathers were Soviet prisoners of war during the Second World War in Siberia. It saved both their lives. They were Hungarian soldiers. The Hungarian army had special Jewish units. Largely, they were slaves, and they were required in many cases to be minesweepers. But that saved both grandfathers' lives. Most of their siblings and their parents actually were lost in Auschwitz. And my family raised me to feel deeply grateful for the gift of living a life without fear, that both my grandparents and my parents, my father was born and grew up in Soviet-occupied Budapest, and they understood what it meant to be afraid. To be afraid, particularly as a Jew. I think not enough people really studied the last, you know, 1,000 years of Jewish history and know that in country after country, whether it was Libya, whether it was Iraq, whether it was Poland, whether it was Hungary, like my family, Jews as a tiny community, and a tiny community that often, you know, stayed close together because of the fear of the outside, were often the first scapegoats when an economy turned poor, when a political leader had trouble. And as such, we've learned to be wary of the communities around us, to rely on each other, and to be deeply, deeply grateful for American tolerance and the American gift of being able to dream. That's what brought me into government. I felt like I owed a debt, a deep, deep debt for this country giving my family a chance to build a new life. And I must say that, you know, I spent almost 20 years in the intelligence community and then at the White House, and each day felt like a privilege. And I think in some ways, to your point about being not only an Orthodox Jew, but a woman, living in so many different communities. In the beginning, I tried very hard to just keep the two lives distinct. I had my religious life with its set of rules, particularly for a woman, and I had my professional life. And I learned over time that the values and the ability to just try to contribute wherever you were, really, one could only be one person in both. So the older I get, and certainly during this time of reflection, as you note, that begins this evening, the more I realize that in America, it's not that we try to be a melting pot. It's that we each try to bring what our history and our families bring to that greater whole and remain distinct. And I think it's a moment in time in America where each of us taking time to learn each community's stories and respect those stories is particularly, particularly needed.
I couldn't imagine adding anything to that. So I'll just wish both of you a happy and prosperous and peaceful New Year.
I will add one thing to Anne's story, which is early in my career, one of my colleagues was probably known to both of you, Dan Kurtzer, who was U.S. ambassador to Israel and to Egypt, and was very involved in the Arab-Israeli peace process for years and has written on it subsequently. And Dan, too, was an Orthodox Jew. And I was part of the West Bank Gaza Autonomy Talks delegation in my first tour, and we would be going back and forth between Tel Aviv and Cairo in these negotiations on a U.S. government defense attaché plane, with which I would supply Dan with kosher chickens so that he could keep his kitchen kosher in Cairo, which was no mean feat. And later in life, when I was having some concerns about my Foreign Service career, because as both of you know, in the national security world, despite all this talk of lazy federal workers who don't do anything, people are working pretty much 6, maybe 7 days a week, 24/7. But Dan Kurtzer taught me something very, very valuable that stayed with me for my rest of my career, mostly in the observance, sometimes in the breach, which is you can make a very good career in the Foreign Service without working every Saturday. So,
yeah. Well, I guess I will add just one really very minor vignette. So I used to go with our friend Doug Lute, who we've had on, to Iraq and Afghanistan. And his aide, who was a wonderful Marine colonel, insisted that he would make sure that, by golly, I would have a kosher TV dinner wherever we went. And I have a picture of myself holding a kosher TV dinner, standing in the Khyber Pass. And I, and the caption is, "Only in America."
There you go.
But the truth is, I think all three of us just feel very deeply grateful to this country.
I've had many "Only in America" moments and memories, yeah. Some related to kosher food, you're right, some related to Shabbat observance, yep, as well, yep, and some just recognizing how exceptional just the country is. And it, so I very much, very much agree. And I suspect we can share very many kosher funny stories from around the world at some point.
But meanwhile, the sun is setting, so I think we better sign off. Shana Tova to you both.
Shana Tova u'Mitzukah. Sweet and good New Year to you both. And to all your listeners, be well.